We'll open the House Committee on Revenue. We welcome you. This is the 10th of May. It's just a couple minutes after 1 o'clock. Today we have on the agenda a House Bill 2338 set for work session, and that was to move it to the House Committee on Budget. We've been since told that the House Committee on Budget, we sent that down to the House Committee on Budget. The question was whether it should have gone to Ways and Means. By implied consent, it went to either one of them or both. So we are not going to do a work session on House Bill 2338. I will, however, open a public hearing on Senate Bill 480 as A and Groves. Paul?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 480, actually you have seen parts of this bill in House bills that you've had hearings on, specifically 2486, which was an amnesty, 2487, which had some compliance material in it. Actually, 2486 was a voluntary compliance initiative, and then 2455, which was a general amnesty as well as a voluntary compliance initiative. So you've seen pieces of this in House bills that you've had hearings on. The Senate essentially started from scratch and put together a number of the elements of those bills and some other things, and that's what they came up with was Senate Bill 480. I'll walk through briefly with you the main parts of the bill, and I have an outline for you that just is labeled Senate Bill 480. The Senate Bill 480 has three main components to it. The first is on abusive tax shelters and voluntary compliance initiative. And remember our discussion earlier about the California experience. And that's really what it's patterned after is the California initiative of about a year and a half ago. What the bill does is define an abusive tax shelter. Conceptually, it's a transaction with no economic substance, but the bill goes in and refers to listed transactions that are listed by the Internal Revenue Service. It does give DOR some additional rulemaking authority to go beyond the IRS code on listed and reportable transactions.
Anything that we're omitting from the IRS code that's presently listed as a abusive tax shelter, Paul?
No, Mr. Chair. It picks up the IRS code and uses that as the base. So
and
it refers to that specific
rulemaking authority.
So it gives rulemaking authority to potentially go beyond, and it does refer to transactions with no economic substance. So Department of Revenue would have some ability to define that in their rulemaking. It does impose a new 20% penalty on each abusive tax shelter going forward from the effective date of the bill. It imposes a new penalty of up to 100% of gross income on promoters of abusive tax shelters. In other words, it would penalize the promoters for the entire amount of revenue that they earn from the transaction.
Is there any provision to catch up with those guys? Usually they're out of the country.
Mr. Chair, there is the abusive tax shelter, or the promoters are for a forward going or ongoing penalty. There isn't anything to go back in time. There's not specific provisions in the bill in terms of finding them out of the state. There is, however, and Deborah, I'm sure we'll talk with you about this. There is. The states have gotten together, particularly taking California's lead and working together on sharing information, and the department does have a fair amount of information on the California efforts. The bill allows Department of Revenue to examine returns for abusive tax shelter activity going back 10 years. This is 2 years back, further back than California did in their VCI program. It establishes the Voluntary Compliance Initiative, and it would begin November 1, 2005, and would run for 90 days through January 31, 2006. And it does create at this time period where those who have engaged in abusive transactions can file amended returns without penalty, and interest on underpayments would still be required. So if you go back 6 years, you would still have to pay those interest requirements. There is not in this bill an appeal process, which was adopted in California. Remember the discussion we had that three-fourths of the California dollars that came in through the VCI had appeal rights to them. And it's still unclear how those will be sorted out. So the Senate's decision was not to, their concern was over fiscal impact on the Department of Revenue and the uncertainty that it would create on the revenue stream. The expected revenue from this element of the bill is $11.4 million, and that's in the 05-07 biennium. The fiscal impact is $12,000, and we have worked closely with the Department of Revenue because they did, as you recall, explain to you in their budget package, governor's recommended budget, they do have some resources committed to looking at abusive tax shelters, so it is something that is an ongoing process for them. What's really new is the VCI period, in which dollars would come in for those who are seeking a way to avoid potential penalties. We've also made an effort, and this will be certainly true in the next component of this, to give you a revenue impact that we would consider to be a net impact, net of the money that would have come in otherwise. So what I did was I made an estimate based on the California experience, and then I subtracted out the amount of money that the Department of Revenue has identified so far, they think, in abusive tax shelters. So we didn't want to double count and add money in that we think probably would come in whether this bill passed or not. The second element is a general amnesty program, and that's something that, again, we've talked a good deal about, and 40 states have had a general amnesty program. Oregon, of course, has not. The Department of Revenue is directed to run the program between July 1, 06 and September 30th of 06. Taxpayers who have received notice of deficiency or been assessed a tax by DOR or who were eligible for the VCI are not eligible for the program. So those that are already in the system are not eligible for the program. And the Senate did spend a lot of time looking at that. We made some estimates, and we can show you those estimates if you'd like to consider a broader group. Basically, what happens, though, we think, is you end up getting more money in 05-07, but you end up losing money in 07-09. So there's very little net gain over the four-year period. So you, in effect, bring some money forward. And, of course, if you have people already identified, then and allow them, for example, to not pay penalties or back interest, then those dollars would have to be reduced from the revenue forecast that would normally be coming in. So we'd net those out. But again, we've got some detailed estimates I'd be happy to go through the committee on. Then there are carrots and sticks, as there always is in general amnesty programs. The carrots are that all tax and civil penalties are waived for participants, not interest, but tax and civil penalties. Again, that was something was discussed, and the Senate was pretty evenly divided on whether they wanted to include interest exclusion or not. Taxpayers may enter an installment plan for repayment. They just have to come forward by the September 30th deadline. The main stick in the program is a 25% post-amnesty penalty on top of existing penalties. And there is, as some states, Washington, for example, have had a public listing of taxpayers' unpaid taxes of those with the largest liability. So posted essentially on the website, and that's a kind of a shaming effort to as a stick. We do estimate, again, on a net basis, netting out those dollars we think we would get under current law, $10.1 million from this aspect of the program. This does have a bigger fiscal impact because we're expecting a much bigger number of taxpayers involved here to participate in the program, and so that's why the fiscal impact is $681,000 compared to $12,000 in the VCI. By the way, on the estimates, a number of taxpayers, the model I used, just because I thought it was recent and it was laid out so well in terms of the components of it, was the Michigan amnesty of 2002. And so, of course, I scaled down all those estimates for Michigan's economy and so forth. The third element of the bill is really what you heard in House Bill 2487, except for the first line there. There is a review of the rewards program, which was part of 480 and not part of 2487. But the other elements are, we're all in 2487. Conforms withholding requirements for retirement income to federal law, requires a withholding of 4% of proceeds for non-resident real estate transaction, and just 4% of the value of the sale price of the residence, and then presumably that would be settled at the end of the tax year, whether that 4% was actually liability or not. Local governments who impose a local income tax, like the I-tax, and that will be expiring soon in Multnomah County, can request and have the DOR collect taxes through the state system, basically adding another line and collecting through the state system. They have to conform to certain requirements. It can't be over 1%. And has to meet the tax base, obviously, of the state, and can't have different exemptions and so forth.
They don't tax the same way the state taxes presently, do they?
The I-tax does use the same state base. It doesn't. It's actually more than the 1% limit that's in the bill. So it is. The rate is actually above what's in the bill. It does allow the department in this agreement with local governments to be reimbursed through the collection. So there would be a collection fee in effect. So there would be any fiscal impact on the Department of Revenue would be paid by the tax imposing district. It also has a requirement that any state agency, or not a requirement, but gives them authority, state agencies that have issue occupational licenses, to require applicants to demonstrate they've complied with state tax law. And the combined impact of this section, fiscal impact, is $1.4 million for setting up the income tax collection system, and these dollars would be reimbursed by the income tax collecting unit. So the net effect, revenue impact, and you've probably seen this number floating around on discussions about balancing the overall state general fund budget. The estimate is plus $21.4 million for 05-07, and we do have a very small ongoing impact that would be due to increased penalties over time, particularly the abusive tax shelter penalty, and estimated about a net gain of about $1.2 million in 07-09 and 09-11 as we're going forward. I did want to update you on a couple of things just in my collecting information in my spare time. The Department of Revenue in Illinois has just completed their program, or completed January 31st, on a voluntary compliance initiative. And they said that they reported 700 taxpayers participated in the program and made nearly $135 million in payments, which was $35 million more than was projected by the Illinois DOR. It did impose a 30% penalty for failing to disclose, a new 30% penalty on deficiencies. So there was a significant stick involved in the Illinois example. There are differences in the Illinois, and I think you probably see some references to potential amendments that may look at some of the Illinois characteristics. The last thing I have is California's amnesty program that, remember, the last time we talked about this issue was ongoing. It had started February 1. And the early results are that it brought in $777 million in income tax payments, $128 million in sales tax. They had an appeal-like process, protective refund, protective claim process, and they brought in $3.4 billion. It's a staggering $3.4 billion. So even with the factor of 10 for Oregon, that would be a huge, huge sum. But again, like the VCI, these are dollars that we're not sure are going to stay there if they're filed under protective claims. So nothing like that is in 480 right now. So that's the net effect is over $700 million in income tax payments for California. And by size, divide that by, 1 to 10 ratio would be equivalent to $78 million in Oregon. So pretty considerable amount of revenue in the California amnesty.
Questions of staff? Thank you very much, Paul.
Representative Boquist.
Yeah, Representative Boquist.
A couple questions, Paul. up in your first paragraph there, DRR to examine taxes, going back 10 years, what's the statute of limitations? Is it unlimited? Is it 7 years? Is it...
There, Representative Boquist, there is not a statute of limitation for non-filers. There is a 3-year limitation on those that have filed, but for non-filers, there is not a statute of limitation.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please follow up. Yes.
Under the general amnesty, it goes July 1 to September 30th, 3 or 4 months. I don't know, but in your recollection of studying other states who did an amnesty program, I mean, is the goal the 3 or 4 month window where you're doing a media blitz and trying to get everybody in, or why is it 3 or 4 months versus 6 months? Or
well, I think there's a couple of issues. One, you mentioned the media blitz, and yes, that is important, and that does show up in analysis of other amnesties that people obviously have to know about it. And while I know it pains us at times, not everybody's watching as closely what goes on here in the Capitol building. So there isn't a lot of direct information oftentimes, and it does affect, more dollars that are spent in terms of marketing does affect the amount of dollars that come in. I think the reason for the timing and the 3-month period is that the whole concept of an amnesty really is to bring money forward. I mean, you're more affecting the time frame, and so most states have thought of it in terms of the fiscal year, so you want to have a fairly condensed, consolidated period where you bring money in. The other thing is what tends to happen is if you have a 6-month or a 1-year period, everybody comes in on the last day, or near the last day. So, you end up not gaining much from that additional time.
Follow up,
please, Representative.
Then is the fiscal impact at the bottom of that paragraph, that's $381,000, does that include the cost to do a media program? Or
It does have an assumption of a media and outreach program. I'll have Deborah talk about that a little bit. She prepared the fiscal impact, or the department did, and that is one of the areas where it's in the bill, it's pretty ill-defined. It just says the department shall publicize and make people aware, but that would be something they'd have a lot of discretion on.
Final question, Mr. Chair.
Please.
So at the bottom, it says net revenue gain of $21.4 million. That's net revenue gain outside of the existing revenue forecast.
That's correct, Representative Boquist. That would be in addition to the forecast you get on Friday if this bill becomes law as is. That 21 would be added to your May forecast.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions of staff? We have about a dozen people, or half dozen, a little better than half dozen folks signed up, and I would like an opportunity at some point to hear from Deborah Buchanan from the Department of Revenue. But let's go ahead with the testimony. We've been provided written testimony from a number of folks. We have Mike Roach first, and then Del Dybig, and Marilee Carr. We have written testimony from those folks. Please.
Okay. Chair Butler and distinguished members of the House Revenue Committee, my name is Mike Roach. As a 27-year member of the National Federation of Independent Businesses and a 3-year member of the Oregon Business Association, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify before you on the issue of tax fairness through better tax compliance. I come before you because I want to speak to the critical importance of maintaining a business environment where everyone pays his or her fair share of taxes. It's the obligation of government to see that this is so. I see taxes as the rent we pay for the business environment and infrastructure, from banking and transportation to public safety and an educated workforce, upon which our success as business people rests. 30 years ago, last month, my mother, Phyllis Roach, and I opened our store, Paloma Clothing, on a hope and a prayer that we could succeed against terrific odds. Prepared to work hard, but knowing we were very short on actual retail experience, we made our first conscious decision to seek help from the government, and my mother was a Republican, when we sought out the services of the Service Corps of Retired Executives from the Small Business Administration. The SBA program was an early investment in us from the U.S. government and Mr. Landauer, the former buyer for the Littman Wolf department store, with whom the SBA matched us. Mr. Landauer held our hands for the first year, the entire first year. His most memorable advice was delivered to us at the end of a particularly slow month in his not-so-slight German accent. Phyllis and Mike, you must understand that to be in retail, you must have nerves of steel. This is as we were crying the blues, of course, about how slow it had been and, you know, some bad days and so on. And I have to say that my mother and I never forgot his words about the nerves of steel, and we took it both seriously and also laughed about it from time to time. Now, 30 years later, we're a lucky and successful Paloma Clothing with 10 employees. When we pay our federal, state, and local taxes, I think of those taxes as back rent on the critical infrastructure that included Mr. Landauer, an infrastructure that helps us today just as it helped us survive back when we paid little or no tax because our profits were so meager or non-existent. Taxes are how we pay for the infrastructure that enables businesses to operate at a profit. We're really just renting a complex, interdependent system of public infrastructure, with public safety being among the most important components. If all businesses and individuals are not paying their fair rent, it leaves the rest of us either paying still more rent or facing a deteriorating public infrastructure, both of which threaten small business survival. We are not afraid of our competitors, but we need to be confident that they are paying their taxes and not reaping an unfair advantage over those of us who do pay fully. Without strong compliance efforts, the knowledge that some other store was recently audited, or the experience of having one's own books checked, it's easy for cash businesses like our own to find excuses for not participating fully in the tax system. So I urge you to be bold in your efforts to recreate a much more level playing field on this critical issue of actual and perceived tax compliance. Thank you very much for your time today. It's appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Roach, and congratulations on your success in your business, too.
Well, I say to the customers who are sometimes shocked to see that we've had been in business 30 years, I say we've made a few more right decisions than wrong ones, and that's the difference.
Dale Diebig?
Yes, my name is Dale Diebig. I am a resident of Salem, and the testimony which I'm about to give is my own opinion. I'm a former federal government employee who worked in tax, so in any case, I urge you to vote for the Senate Bill 480, which provides for the general tax amnesty, a tax shelter amnesty, and then penalties for failure to disclose participation in tax shelters. Now, Senate Bill 480, obviously, there are different people who have different opinions on it, and there is room for improvement. However, I think you should pass 480, and if it can be modified, fine. If it can't, I would say go ahead the way it is. With respect to the general tax amnesty, testimony before Congress by a variety of people and tax experts all agree that there's a very large tax gap. This is the difference between taxes that are collected and those which are legally due. My own estimate previously when I gave testimony in front of this committee is that the Oregon tax gap is $1 billion annually, recurring annually. That is a lot of money. This tax gap is in large part attributable to people and businesses not subject to third-party reporting, such as forms W-2. Others, whose income is not subject to third-party reporting, also play the audit lottery and interpret the tax code to their benefit. According to a recent academic study, a substantial portion of the annual tax gap is attributable to overstatement of the tax cost basis of assets sold. Now, some self-employed individuals, through lack of knowledge, planning, foresight, go into business and then find out that they have to pay tax. By that time, they don't have any money. And so at that point in time, they may fail to file or underreport their taxable income. people who don't understand the tax system or haven't had experience or an education in business and who face financial difficulties may resort to illegal acts. And I believe these people should qualify for a general tax amnesty, but only once and for the purpose of giving them a fresh start. The evasion or intentional understatement of gross income is not a matter of complexity, and it's very hard to excuse, at least in my mind. On the other hand, not everybody is an accounting major like I was, and those people who don't have my background in finance and accounting should deserve a fresh start without fear of the penalties or the prosecution. Now, serial tax offenders, people who repeatedly violate tax laws, whether it's individually or through use of related entities, I don't think they should get any kind of a tax break. They should have known better. With respect to the tax shelter amnesty, in this case, neither the states nor the federal government have the legal resources to litigate the tax shelter cases that are currently on the plate. There are too many of them, and each individual case would take tremendous resources to litigate, so basically the solution is you've got to settle. And basically this is what the amnesty would do. Now, tax shelter participants who are already deep in hock and who may face tax liabilities, they may try to delay the day of reckoning, and chances are that their advisors, while they're running the meter, will encourage them to do just that. Other people may decide to make a clean break and disclose and get it behind them. This is basically, I think, what the people that the tax shelter amnesty would look to in order to take advantage of this program. Now, if Oregon takes initiative in this manner and publicizes it, it puts the public on notice that, number one, somebody is looking, that the well-to-do who engage in these tax shelters are paying tax, and this perhaps will give the public a little bit more sense of confidence that they're not the only ones paying tax. With respect to the tax shelter disclosure and penalties, this is basically a first step, and in terms of dealing with tax shelter losses, and many of the provisions in SB 480 are duplicated in federal law, but I believe they should also be enacted in state law. The reason for it is that right now, based on a GAO report which came out very recently, in which I've incorporated as Exhibit C, there are 10,164 individuals and corporations in the IRS database as of May 2003. And the numbers, both tax dollars at the federal level and the tax losses in there, are tremendous. They are huge, both individually and collectively. I have absolutely no idea how much is in Oregon. It should be less than what's in California as a proportion of the economy, but I leave it up to your imagination in terms of looking at the federal data to see just how large the impact is on tax shelters. Now, what my fear is what will happen. I was involved in reviewing tax shelters back in the late 70s and early 80s. And what happened is that initially tax shelters were focused on the very well-to-do, doctors who did extremely well, generally non-business people, and ultimately towards the 80s, prior to 86, we ended up with permutations, combinations of these tax shelters. Many of them were just basically set up on pure paper. There weren't even any real assets, and they were out and right fraudulent. They duplicated the same assets, and they were being sold to middle-income taxpayers. And this is possibly what might happen if you don't take the initiative with respect to the larger tax shelters that are being marketed to the well-to-do. Now, with respect to the penalties in 480, a number of them are very similar as to what is incorporated in federal law in Section 6707, capital A. But there's one penalty in 480, Section 12, parenthesis 2, that I think could have a little bit of improvement. And I'd be happy to explain it to anybody who's interested, legislative counsel. And finally, tax evasion I don't think will ever be eliminated, but Senate Bill 480 would not be needed if we had a perfect law enforcement, tax law enforcement program. Therefore, I would recommend that the Department of Revenue, that funding for it should be a priority, because it will give those of us who do pay our tax bills a little bit more confidence that other people are paying theirs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Google. Dr. Carr?
Thank you. Chair Butler and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I'm Marilee Carr, a family physician living in Portland and practicing in Beaverton. I also have warm connections to Oregon City, where I was a partner in the family practice clinic for 8 years. I think SB 480 is a good bill, and I urge you to pass it, but with a few additions. SB 480 catches up with the trend in tax law enforcement, creating a website listing the names of the worst offenders among individual tax delinquents. More than a dozen states have made public on these public embarrassment websites for honest taxpayers to see these lists of individuals and corporations who are evading their responsibilities. Offenders can keep their names off the public list by paying their obligations or being in payment plans. However, for some reason, our version, SB 480, only provides for listing the names of the worst tax offenders among individuals. Corporations who shirk their tax responsibilities and take unfair advantage of honest competitors and honest customers would not be exposed to the public judgment of their customers and competitors under this version of SB 480. Violating the law is just as wrong for them as it is for individuals. The majority of businesses who fulfill their responsibilities and help to build Oregon need and deserve a business climate in which their tax-evading unfair competitors are exposed to public judgment. Several of these state websites have clever, attention-getting names. Louisiana hosts the Cyber Shame website, Maryland posts names on Caught in the Web, and South Carolina lists tax delinquents in Debtor's Corner. Oregonians are known around the world for our originality and creativity, and Tax Fairness Oregon thinks we can do better. SB 480 provides for a broad public information campaign to announce the amnesty period, the media blitz, and to announce the increased penalties for evasion. We suggest that as part of the public information campaign, the law provide for a contest to name the Oregon website, with an essay contest in adult and school-age divisions to take this issue home with homework on the topic of tax obligations to each other. Winning entries could be posted on the website. Perhaps a gift certificate for books could be awarded to the winners. Of course, the prizes could not include discounts on the winners' future tax bills, whatever grade they are in.
You think Al Capone's daughter would turn them in?
Oh, well, if she could get something for it. Now, on a related topic, forgiving of penalties and just keeping track of that process, not every delinquent taxpayer is the same. And fortunately, the Oregon Department of Revenue has wide discretion to forgive tax liabilities, penalties, and interest. And certainly, there are compassionate and civic reasons in many cases to reduce the delinquent tax bills of repentant offenders, to bring them back into the fold and back on track. However, there's currently no reporting or accounting or measurement of this reduction of taxes and penalties. And SB 480 also does not provide for any accounting of amounts paid and forgiven under the amnesty that we may enact here. Due diligence for a new program, such as the tax amnesty, demands evaluation and analysis of the amounts paid and forgiven. We urge you to require the Department of Revenue to provide a clear and complete accounting of the amounts paid and forgiven for various categories of taxpayers under the amnesty program. The Department of Revenue has, in effect, an ongoing amnesty for corporate tax evaders. Tax Fairness Oregon has been told by staff at the Department of Revenue that it is standard department procedure to forgive penalties for tax delinquent corporations that turn themselves in. The penalties under law, which are increased by SB 480, are applied to those corporations which are apprehended by the department, but with slashed enforcement budgets and shrinking staff at both the IRS and the DOR, corporations must know that there is little chance of getting caught. We urge you to require the Department of Revenue to provide a clear and reasonably complete accounting of the amounts paid and forgiven for various types of taxpayers in its normal operations. There may be good reasons for this departmental standard, but we should know what they are. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you very much, Dr. Farr. Is there questions of any of these folks? I'll get them here. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Let's see. We have Joe Schweinhart and Jack Monroe.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm having handed out now some testimony, or at least a letter, from the Oregon Bankers Association. They were unable to be here today because they've got about six bills up in another committee, but I'm sure they will testify at our next public hearing. So let me first go into their letter. We are here opposed to this bill, and for the bankers, I'd like to read out they give five main objections to this legislation. First, the Voluntary Compliance Initiative, while voluntary, appears to have no limitation in the exposure for voluntary compliance. Second, this bill will allow Oregon's Department of Revenue to look back 10 years to determine and impose penalties for prior transactions, including penalties for prior transactions they deem abusive. We believe this vests too much of an authority with the Department of Revenue, and the 10-year look-back should concern all businesses and CPAs and others relative to records retention. Third, as we work toward growing Oregon's economy, this bill will take valuable resources away from economic development and perhaps divert those resources to compliance issues. Even worse, businesses may be motivated to minimize their activity in Oregon. Fourth, under the VCI program, there appears to be no provision for a taxpayer to protect their rights to a refund for overpaid tax if their participation in the VCI program was deemed unnecessary. And I think for the record, I need to introduce myself, Joe Schweiner of Associated Oregon Industries. I'd like to follow up that testimony with my own, and I'll make it very short, that we are very much opposed to this bill as it stands right now. This bill gives the Department of Revenue entirely too much power as a state agency over the taxpayer. DOR will have the power to deem any transaction abusive. Many of their interpretations could be subjective, and this bill, which is to address abusive tax situations, actually could or will create one. This bill makes certain legal transactions illegal, then goes back 10 years to penalize those legal transactions. This is unfair to the taxpayer, and this will cause an undue burden on the taxpayer, a burden which I'm sure is not your intention. This bill is a flawed tax measure which is much more extreme than any other state. This gives Oregon harsher corporate tax environment at a time when we are doubling our recruiting efforts to get more business into the state. Given the opportunity to make changes in that harsh language, to closely follow much fairer language proposed in other states, I believe we can get an agreement on this and bring the bill back to you in a much fairer form. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I urge you to give this issue more time to be resolved and let us come back to you at a time in the future to propose some amendments. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe, and thank you for the information from the Oregon Bankers Association. Mr. Monroe?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe, appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. And this is obviously not my sort of normal beat in the Capitol, but clearly the general objective of the measure is not something that poses a problem for us and you know, one in which we would encourage you to pursue. However, there are a couple of sections in the 480A version that give us some considerable pause to reflect and we think need considerably more consideration and maybe some scenario testing. And those two sections are sections 33, and then I'd offer a couple of comments on 44. They are both provisions that I think fall in your staff summary under the other compliance measures heading. The section 33 essentially directs settlement agents, and most real estate closings in the state are performed by title insurance company escrow agents, hence the interest, require withholding up to 4% of either the consideration or the net proceeds for remittance to the Department of Revenue in situations where a non-resident conveys real property, Oregon real property. And you know, we're concerned about this, I think, both in terms of frankly, the obligations that would fall on us, but more significantly, we think that there are costs and inequities that will result if the concept as it's set forth here is adopted. And ultimately, it might well even cool some transactions. But let me give you just a flavor, and this is certainly not a definitive list. But beginning at the bottom, or beginning at the I guess the foundation level, really the basis for calculating the withholding obligation is unclear. As I said, it's either 4% of the consideration or the net proceeds. And, you know, that raises interesting questions about who calculates what are permissible charges against net proceeds. And let me give you an example. I mean, if Chair Butler were to have purchased a piece of real property for $200,000 in cash in, let's say, 2002, and goes to sell it and wants to sell it for $230,000 in cash, closing costs, let's say, are $20,000. There's a capital gain in that simple example of $10,000. Actually, particularly given the fact that it's a cash transaction, really the whole $230,000 is the consideration, and so the obligation would be there to withhold $9,200 when there's only really $900 in tax liability, and so. There are issues like that that need to be resolved, I guess, if you were to pursue this concept in terms of refining definitions. You know, there you could make it more complicated, too, if there were unsecured loans that were part of it. And you know, it's uncertain, I guess, whether or not we could bring the obligation down to zero or not by paying off unsecured loans. You know, what flows from that, of course, are a series of considerations that might be adverse to Oregonians. I mean, you might have or adverse to the taxpayer. You know, you might have a financially distressed situation here that you can't work out. That money that's being held in trust might have been more productively put to use in some other endeavor. They're also given the definition of conveyance here, which sweeps in things like leases and refinancing. we end up sweeping in a bunch of transactions that really aren't the transactions where taxable gain normally occurs. And so, you know, if it's a refinance situation, how do you calculate what the withholding is? Is it the entire loan amount? Is it some lesser amount? Same thing with a lease. And some leases, some commercial leases, go through closings. So uncertainty there. We have a situation here where, you know, obviously you're obligated to do it if the party is an out-of-state resident or if they're a corporation not doing business in Oregon. And yet, I mean, it speaks in terms of immediately after, but the question sort of is, what's immediately after? Is that a day after, a week after, 6 months after, a year after? How does the closing agent go about determining whether or not there's an office someplace else in the state with a single employee? How do you determine whether or not they don't own property elsewhere in the state? Again, a considerable amount of uncertainty. Another question, does this withholding obligation apply to business entities other than corporations? I think you all know there are partnerships, limited liability companies, trusts, and a variety of other entities out there, and does this section apply or doesn't it apply? Should it apply to a nonprofit corporation? An out-of-state nonprofit it picks up through bequest a piece of Oregon property. You know, they're not going to have any tax liability. Should we be withholding for that kind of entity? So there are a variety of ambiguities, I think, in Section 33 that at a minimum would need to be worked out. And in fact, the whole concept might well be one that doesn't make good sense. The other section that I would just, call to your attention is Section 44, which appears to be a section that sort of deputizes other agencies, those that are granting occupational or professional licenses, to perform certain kinds of tax compliance duties. And I think the threshold question there, frankly, is there some evidence that suggests that people who have those licenses are somehow involved in a higher degree of tax avoidance than anybody else. Now, I do not know the backgrounds of all of the members of the committee, but I think there are at least five of you that have or currently have or have had licenses that are issued by the state, ranging from a peace officer to a school teacher to a CPA to a real estate agent. And I guess the problem that I see here, again, is ambiguity. I mean, the trigger is uncertain. I don't know what demonstrating compliance is, but it appears to set up a situation where, despite the fact that the agency need not, by this provision, make that a requirement for the license or renewal license, it does set up a situation where a variety of different agencies out there could read define that term differently, and so you've got conceivably a bunch of different standards at play. I also think that there are some interesting privacy implications here, where essentially we've created a statutory process, or it's being suggested that we create a statutory process where tax information is shared between the Department of Revenue and these agencies, and I'm not sure that there aren't a great many Oregonians that would be something less than enthusiastic about the potential for either their tax returns or a portion of their tax returns being shared with some agency out there that grants an occupational or professional license. So with those comments in mind, I'd obviously be happy to respond to any questions, and certainly would be happy to work with you as you go through the development of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Monroe. Questions for either Mr. Swinehart or Mr. Monroe? Representative Hass?
Thank you. And Mr. Monroe, where was the line that you said that had the phrase the next day or the...
Immediately after.
Immediately after.
I think it's on, it would be page 16, line 13.
Okay. I would tend to agree with you that that should be cleaned up. And you're not arguing against this concept, just that there's...
Well, I, to make it quite clear, Mr. Chair, Representative Hass, I think we would conclude, frankly, that this, that the whole approach here is probably not an appropriate approach, and because of there's so much variation in the number of and the form of real estate conveyances that occur. That even if we spend a lot of time testing scenarios and defining these terms, I'm not sure we're not going to create inequities. We're certainly going to create problems for closing agents because, you know, they're going to have to document, they're going to have to keep this information. Presumably they're going to be subject to some sort of penalty if they make the wrong decision on the amount of money that has been withheld or not withheld. There are other approaches out there, such as reporting kinds of requirements and whatnot, that may achieve the same objective. I don't know.
Okay. Follow-up. Yes, please, Your Honor.
Mr. Reinhart, your letter says this. Tell me what section that you think DOR has too much power. Is it just the whole bill, or do you have a specific?
No, Mr. Chairman, or Representative Hess, there's provisions that I don't remember exactly which one it is that gives them the authority through rulemaking to determine what's abusive and what's not. And granted, at any given time, they wouldn't have a provision that people may not agree or disagree with, but it could be abusive in terms of what they think is abusive.
Mr. Chairman,
yes, Paul?
How does that differ from the kind of discretion they have now to interpret tax law?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hass, I'm not quite sure what power they have now that they would be able to determine that as being abusive versus what they have now. I'm not sure.
Like right now, isn't it there on line 10 on or 9 on page 2? Line 9 says that it's reportable transaction under 6707A of the Internal Revenue Code, which defines what abusive tax shelters is, I would guess. And what this does, then, it further allows the department the discretion by rule to develop another list of tax avoidance or tax evasion transactions. Maybe that would include people who work for the legislature or something like that.
Mr. After that point, yes.
Not enough to worry about.
Yeah, right. further questions? Yeah, yes, Representative Berger is recognized.
Yeah, I have a similar related question. And Joe, frankly, I was looking for exactly the same thing. Where in here? And I frankly found that line. But in your statement, you said that this would make certain legal activities illegal, and I wondered if specifically you could point to what you're talking about in that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, what I'm discussing here is the fact that it allows Department of Revenue to go back 10 years, and they're going to make a ruling on some of these what are now being called abusive were not abusive in the past.
Okay.
And what they're going to do now is go back and make that ruling that these are abusive and then have 10 years to go back and look at these measures that being abusive. Well, 8 years ago they were not abusive.
Is that different than the California, these reportable transactions under this IRS code? I mean, I'm not sure how that all fits because I don't know what the reportable under the IRS code is. So I'm trying to get a handle on, you know, how this, other states have done similar things, and maybe Paul could address that. Do you understand what I'm getting at here? I'm looking for where in the bill that we need to be pointing to say, okay, how can we stay? I mean, I don't want to be making illegal transactions. I mean, legal, and suddenly go change the whole playing field.
Where is the 10-year statute, Paul? What section of that is it that allows the Department of Revenue to examine tax returns for abusive tax shelter activity going back 10 years versus the 8 years that California has done versus the 6 years that's statutory right now? I'm going to guess that the 6-year look back is part of the 25% omitted income statutes. It's 5 years on the omitted income. Okay.
Rather
than go through this now, I think the point to be made is that there are other states doing other things. California is a little bit tougher than Illinois. Oregon's a little bit tougher than both of them. They go back further, they do more things, they go harsher penalties. What we'd be looking to do is try to make more sense of the bill and make it less punitive and fairer to the taxpayer. And that's what we're looking to do.
Okay.
And I think given time and an ability to work through this and make this language a little more acceptable, we can do that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Other questions of these two panelists? Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Jack.
Thank you.
Let's see. We have Jody Weiser and Margaret Gridsout.
Didn't want to take time. Margaret, no.
Okay.
She didn't give a written testimony.
Okay.
Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon, Chairman Butler and members of the committee. Senate Bill 480 is a good bill. There may be small things that need to be changed. The 10-year go back just provides 2 years longer than California had with the same kind of language because it's a year and several months later now, almost a year and a half later than when they started their amnesty period, and our amnesty period is yet ahead. The what they found when they received forms was that there was kind of a big curve in where they found people who had been cheating on their taxes. And if you want to catch those people during that high period of use of these abusive tax shelters, you have to go back 10 years at this point if Oregon's going to do it. The definitions are the same. An abusive tax shelter is defined in law as a transaction that has been used for no business purpose except to avoid taxes. There is no business risk. You've just created some false event in order to claim that you didn't have income that you did have. But other than that, there's no business risk, and that's what the IRS definitions speak to. The amnesties in this bill are invitations for Oregonians who want to get straight with the law, to get straight with the law. The additional provisions give more meat and more bite to the department so that the department can do things that they can't currently do. I have a lapsed license in this state. Halfway through my period of having a teaching license, I was asked to start providing fingerprints. Now, I don't really love the idea of providing fingerprints, but you know what? That protects children. And I wouldn't love the idea of the fact that I was a tax cheat keeping me from being a teacher. But guess what? That protects other taxpayers, and that's a responsibility that the legislature has. Just as it should protect children from people who are might commit crimes, it needs to protect taxpayers from people who might protect tax crimes. And if somebody wants to get a license that has basically the state of Oregon's approval stamped on it, then they should be willing to have the department look and see if these people who have licenses actually pay taxes on the business income they earned. And when other states have done this kind of matching, they have found little tax cheaters and massive tax cheaters. They found large numbers of professionals in the legal and medical fields not paying any taxes because they were non-filers. And that's what that provision is seeking to do something about. what I really wanted to speak to was the fact that we need to do something about giving the department increased revenues to give real meat to this bill. When California did their tax amnesty, they started with by pulling together 20 people from within their department. By the end of last year, they had 42 people working on abusive tax shelters. This year, they're raising that number to 60. All of the, if you look at the fiscal analysis, all of the positions for both the general and the tax amnesty in our bill are temporary, seasonal, or contract employees. We're not going to have people afraid that they're going to get caught by the state of Oregon if we aren't acting like we're going to be still in business working on abusive tax shelters afterwards. The governor's budget put 6% in additional money for the Department of Revenue in the next biennium. Well, 6% is basically cost of living for 2 years. Tax Fairness asked that you increase that to 15%. The first year, 15%, the second year. It wouldn't work to give a huge jump all at once because it takes time to train people in, and you're not going to get a 8-to-1 return in the first year of somebody's involvement with the Department of Revenue, but they'll probably be able to pay their salary because that doesn't really require that much tax collecting. And as we know, there's $1 billion out there not being collected. The former commissioner of the Department of Revenue just wrote a book, Charles Rosati, and I want to read one section from it. In 2002, he says, the IRS was not even able to follow up on most of the cases in which it knew of specific taxpayers who were not paying, even in cases in which taxpayers were seriously abusing the system. The IRS has been underfunded by had their funding cut by 36% in the last decade. Our department has not grown, despite the fact that tax complexities have grown, and of course the number of taxpayers in our state has grown. So obviously there's just not as many people out there doing compliance and collection work as there used to be between the IRS and the Oregon Department of Revenue. Of the taxpayers who the IRS believed with high probability were either not filing returns at all or were using abusive trusts and overseas accounts to hide income or were underreporting very large amounts of income, more than 70% could not be pursued because of the lack of resources. The IRS is simply outnumbered when it comes to dealing with the millions of individuals and businesses that are not paying what they owe. It is like a lone cop seeing crooks robbing all four banks on a corner and having no choice but to just watch three of them drive away. So when you consider this legislation, instead of picking it to get death in little teeny pieces, I suggest that you give it real strength by giving the department the resources to really be tax collectors, tax enforcers, so that all of us in the state who are honest are not the only ones that are paying our share. And in fact, I think it's our obligation. The governor's budget suggests $167 million for the next biennium. We would suggest $196 million.
What's that for?
For the Department of Revenue.
We're not a budget committee. You knew that.
I know that. I know, but is it not true, Chairman Butler, that you can put money provisions in a bill, or is that only done in budget?
We don't have the authority to do any kinds of appropriation. That's a whole different issue.
All right. Well, then when you in your other committees, wherever you have that power, I sure hope that you will ask for money for the department to make this bill a worthy bill.
Separate part of the building for that.
Okay. And in terms of the representative banker's concerns, perhaps he's worried about this bill and the 10-year go-back because banks in some states are really having to pay up. The tax shelters they've used, and they are tax shelters that are not defined in the IRS code because they're breaking the state code but not a federal code. Banks have been taking their assets and naming them into Nevada where there is no income tax, something that they have done for no business purpose except to avoid state income tax. And I'm not sure which it is. It was the first bank that they caught paid, it was either $27 or $40 million in back taxes to their state. So if Oregon banks have been using the same techniques to lower their bank of their tax bills, then they of course would be concerned about the state checking into that, and hopefully you'll not be worried about their getting caught, but instead hope that if they have been abusing the tax system, they are caught. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Pleasure? Thank you very much, Representative Pearson. You're the last person to have signed up. There's at least one other person that would like to talk. Why don't you come forward? And I know that you've got a number of amendments in this bill from the Senate version that came late on in the Senate bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative Greg McPherson, House District 38. And you're absolutely right. Significant portions of Senate Bill 480 are identical to House Bills 2486 and 2487 that this committee heard previously. And the portions that are carried over from those bills were the abusive tax shelter piece, the two new withholdings on retirement distributions and real estate transactions, the occupational license piece, and there's a general withholding provision as well. I wanted to respond to some of the comments that have been made before. The 10-year period is baffling to me. There was nothing that I had understood about the design of the program in California that involved 10 years and then was carried over here. The instruction to legislative council was to model the abusive tax shelter piece on the California program, and if there's something about 10 years that got in there that is different from California's, then we ought to find it and straighten it out. But the aim was simply to replicate a program that had been done in a neighboring state with great success, and I think we ought to give it a roll here to see how effective it is. And I don't, you know, you can characterize efforts to make sure people pay their taxes as being punitive. I don't think it's punitive. I think it's just good citizenship. I think we all of us pay our taxes, and the other good citizens of Oregon pay their taxes, and they expect us to do a good job of making sure that the relatively small number of businesses and individuals who opt not to pay have to pony up, so that we're all paying for the services that we all use. Now, with respect to some of the detail points, the real estate withholding piece, it was modeled on the Colorado statute, so it's not as though it's, you know, brand new material that's never been tried. It's a system that is operating effectively in Colorado. It does have some of the challenges to it that were identified by the previous witness. That is, it does apply a withholding tax that is based on the sale price. And I think the definition of what a conveyance is probably stated too broadly in the statute, in the bill. It was, again, modeled on the Colorado statute. The aim here is to help make sure that an out-of-state seller of Oregon real estate who owes Oregon income tax, because they're not in Oregon and not otherwise filing a tax return, doesn't have a memory lapse. They kind of forget about that obligation they have in Oregon once the proceeds have been transmitted out of state. And if we withhold from that transaction something, even if they don't owe all of that, they can file and get a refund. Now, that may not be the only way to skin that cat, and I'm certainly open to other techniques if we can identify a reporting mechanism so that we're sure that information is getting to the Oregon Department of Revenue. I'm certainly open to that, and I'd be happy to work with the representatives of the title industry to work out something that fits into the way they do business.
Greg, do you do any real estate closings or any real estate law in your...
In my law practice, Mr. Chair, I don't do any real estate law.
Okay. The question I've got is with regard to the W-4 statement that's required to be filed at that point. Normally, there's a W-4 that you sign that says I'm exempt from the withholding. That would be perjury. So the person would, if they said, well, I don't owe any tax on this transaction, at that point you've got both perjury and tax fraud. The state of Oregon, do you know if they use their long arm to reach outside of the state?
Chair Butler, I'm not aware that they do, and under current law, there is no withholding requirement applicable to a real estate closing transaction, because what this bill proposes to do is to create a withholding obligation from the closing proceeds.
There is a federal withholding requirement, except that you file W-4 and can get around that. But maybe we've got a real estate rep here that may know the answer to that.
Well, I don't really know the answer to that question, but my curiosity is, what if you do an IRC 1031 exchange? You do it in the state of Oregon, you buy a piece of property in California, and turn to an IRC 1031, do it in Washington. Now, how do you track that?
Well, Chair Butler, Representative Esquivel, that's actually a very good point. And no tax is due upon a 1031 exchange, even when one is exchanging for property outside the state of Oregon. And this bill doesn't change that situation. So there would be no tax due in that scenario. Now, interestingly enough, what I'm told what happens is that there is an obligation to pay Oregon income tax upon the sale of the property that you exchanged into, even if that property is outside the state of Oregon. And I'd have to guess that the...
That was overturned.
Chair Butler, I defer to your greater knowledge if you're familiar with it, because I'm just reciting what a person who's in the title industry told me about how that works. But
that law was overturned, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, where Oregon was reaching out, no longer allowed exchanges of property out of the state of Oregon without having a nexus to come back and allow that person to sell it. Or when you changed your residency to outside the state of Oregon, then you had to pay that Oregon tax as you moved out of state. That was deemed to be unconstitutional and was later overturned. I think it was John DiLorenzo that prevailed in that particular case.
Well, Chair Butler, I will defer to your greater expertise on that particular area. In any event, it's not. It's 1031 exchanges are not addressed in this bill. This is dealing with taxable sales of real estate. And as I say, our aim here is not to create an additional burden on the title industry in how to close real estate transactions. It's simply to make sure that there's a flow of information to the Department of Revenue on taxable transactions, not 1031 exchanges, so that people who are out-of-state owners of Oregon real estate don't forget to pay their tax to Oregon. And if we can skin that cat another way, I'm pleased to do it.
But the 1031 is a deferred exchange, so there might be cash sitting around that would then be transferred to another escrow agent at some other point.
Well, it would be a facilitator.
Facilitator.
Right.
So at that particular point, we'd have to figure out how to get the facilitators involved in this, because frequently that cash at least moves one time in a 1031 and could move several times in a 1031 until the final deal it facilitates within the, was it 180 days or by the end of the filing?
Right.
I guess I'm concerned about that. Now, where does it show that the 1031 is in fact exempt? I'm sorry, I'm looking for that.
It's right in here.
Okay.
And it appears, Mr. Chair, that Representative Esquivel has that citation, so I'll defer to him if he's looked it up.
All right,
but in any event, it's certainly not the aim of this bill to create a tax obligation on a transaction that is under existing law already exempt. And if there's another way to solve this problem, as I say, I'm quite open to solving it another way. We want to make sure is that those people who are out of state and are not otherwise filing an Oregon return are have an obligation to pay up in Oregon that is enforced, because we have a flow of information, so they aren't just sort of receiving a wire transfer of closing escrow proceeds and then figuring, well, the money's outside of Oregon and I don't owe anything. Now, with respect to the comments on occupational licenses, one of the questions asked was, well, is this particularly a problem for professionals? People who are licensed by the state, and based on at least something I remember hearing some years ago, I'm embarrassed to say, yes, it is. I remember hearing from an old IRS agent many years ago that the highest level of tax noncompliance is among lawyers. And they say something about either the ethics of the profession or maybe their knowledge of, you know, how effective the system is at catching people who don't pay up. But I think it is a problem there are people who get a very valuable license from the state and who don't pay up what they owe. What's contemplated here is not something that's going to be a major dragnet out on all points bulletin to chase after licensees who haven't paid up. What the Department of Revenue contemplates with this authority, because it's an optional thing. It's there's a critical may in there in the language on the occupational license piece, which means that there would be a pilot program that would identify one agency or maybe two or three agencies that issue licenses. And what they would do is...
The pilot program ought to start with lawyers.
I think, well, Mr. Chair, I would invite that. because I am someone who's paid his tax and filed his returns. It would simply mean getting a tax ID number, Social Security number, or if it's a professional partnership, it might be an EIN, and just comparing that number to what the information in the Department of Revenue has to make sure that they match up and that, in fact, the person who's got this valuable license is, in fact, filing a return to report the income that they earn with that license. And you can say it's an invasion of privacy. I don't see anything that is public about that. I think the piece that lists the highest to largest non-payers, there may be a privacy issue in that. But as to this piece of the bill, the occupational licensees, it doesn't disclose to the general public that information. It just makes sure that these people have a match, that they are in fact generating a return. Then the last piece I wanted to comment on, although it wasn't discussed yet among the witnesses, is the collection of local income tax. Now, that was the source of a fairly stiff fiscal estimate that was done on the Senate side, and it relates to the timing, that significant fiscal, relates to the timing by which these events would occur. There's nothing about the design of that piece that should generate a net cost to the state, because the whole concept here is to use the system that the Department of Revenue has to collect local income taxes to the extent that our local governments enact them, by using an additional line item on the Oregon Form 40 so that a taxpayer who resides in a jurisdiction that has enacted such a tax then puts that surcharge or surtax on the return, the state return, rather than having a whole separate administrative structure, which makes really no sense. I mean, it's going to bound to have lower compliance and have a higher cost of administration if you have to build two separate systems for collecting tax and administering it than to have one. And the design of the bill was intended to be to have all those costs of the local government tax reimbursed to the Department of Revenue, and the fiscal that was put on it was only related to the possibility that you could have, within one biennium, you could have upfront costs being expended by the Department of Revenue and then not being recaptured out of the revenue stream until the next biennium. And that, understand, there's some ideas the Department of Revenue has about how to change those provisions of the bill to eliminate that fiscal, and I certainly support that effort, and will be pleased to work with the Department of Revenue on those changes, and with my friends in the title industry and other groups that have concerns about the bill, because I think it's a good bill. This is something we really ought to do. If there's some rough edges, we need to smooth them out and make this thing go.
Something like the National Revenue does in Canada. where it collects the it collects both the state and the federal on the same form, in effect, of the province as well as the national taxation.
Well, Mr. Chair, again, I defer to your greater knowledge about how that's done. I haven't worked with taxes in Canada, but it sounds like the same concept.
So the only concern I would have would be that we'd have a whole different issue relative to when, let's say that the state tax is a 9% and that comes out to 100x, and that the local tax is 0.9% and that comes out to 10x, so that the balance of tax owed is a total of 11x or 110x, whatever. So if it's 110x of tax that's owed, then would there be an estimated tax penalty charged on the local as well? That's something that would have to be sorted out. And then what are the collections? If they only remit 100x, would that have to be divided between the state and the federal, and then they both have to duke it out to see if they can get the other? Or should that go first to the federal and then the 10x be the responsibility of the local jurisdiction? I'm anxious about how that would work, Representative.
Chair Butler, I appreciate your focusing on some details here. The what's intended, and I would have to go back and review the bill again to make sure that this is the case, is that the first dollars in are the state dollars, and it's only what's collected beyond that then that covers the local liability. We don't want to cut into our stream of revenue that we need for state services and for the general fund by obligating the state to share some of what it's collected if there's not enough collected to cover both.
Is the ITAC subject to withholding right now? They're not withholding that, are they?
I don't live in the Multnomah County part of my district, so I would, if there are other their members.
So it comes in on April 15th, basically.
I believe that's right, Chair Butler, that it's simply paid up at when the tax due date, and of course that tends to make a tax rather unpopular if some people have to write checks as opposed to having it disappear from their paycheck before that paycheck comes into their hands. There's no new withholding or estimated tax system created under this bill, and it's one of the reasons why the amount of the total local income taxes to be collected from any one individual is capped at 1%, to avoid getting rather stiff taxes that then go beyond, you know, significantly beyond the estimates and withholding that have been applied.
Okay. I appreciate that. Questions of Representative McPherson. Representative Boquist is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, back to your professional agency or association, Northern Bar Association, in reading Section 43 and 44, Tax Compliance of Occupational License Holders, it's a state agency board or commission that issues occupational licenses. And you brought up the issue of your profession being highly probable. But the way I read this, and I'm not sure, correct me if I'm wrong, how does a lawyer get his license? I think it comes to the Oregon Bar Association, which is not a state agency.
Chair Butler, Representative Boquist, my understanding is the Oregon State Bar is, we have what we call an integrated bar, which means that the Bar Association does perform the licensing function of a state agency. So in that capacity, I believe it is a state agency.
Thank you.
Other questions for Representative McPherson? Thank you very much, Representative.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And then relative to Section 44, I think, Patrick, we've covered it at this particular point. Okay. Deborah, would you like to come forward and just... I appreciate your being here.
Assuming I like lawyers.
I'd like to have you. Do you have a copy of Legislative Revenue Office's analysis of the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I do.
Thank you. Can you give us kind of a synopsis of the issues that we probably need to address to go through some of the items that are here?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to be here, Mr. Chair. This is a very wide-ranging bill, and I've just been scribbling notes, but trying to understand some of the concerns also. Our focus, of course, is whether we can administer the provisions in the bill, and that's what we are concerned about. The policy is yours to decide. We have identified some amendments that we think would be necessary for us to make this work. Starting with the Voluntary Compliance Initiative, I'm just going to try to explain my understanding of what it means to have a reportable transaction, a listed transaction, and if I'm wrong on this, I'm sure I will be corrected, but the way I view reportable transactions under federal law is it's an attempt to red flag something on a tax return so that the tax administration authorities can be aware of it, rather than having transactions buried in perhaps multiple levels of tax returns. They are required to indicate on the return that they have engaged in a reportable transaction. That does not make it an illegal transaction. It simply says, here's something that you may want to look at. So you have that level of reportable transaction. A listed transaction is a kind of reportable transaction. And it gets to be a listed transaction when the IRS identifies it as being one that has the potential for tax abuse. There are notices that are published by the IRS identifying listed transactions. They're also posted on their website. I printed one out today. This is notice 2004-67, which identifies current listed transactions. There are three pages here. That item number 29 is notice 2004-30. And it says, transactions in which S-corporation shareholders attempt to transfer the incidence of taxation on S-corporation income by purportedly donating S-corporation non-voting stock to an exempt organization while retaining the economic benefits associated with that stock is a listed transaction as of April 1, 2004. So that listing triggers certain things. What it triggers is that material advisors who are promoting these types of transactions then need to register that that's what they're doing, and it also provides that there is additional disclosure required. That's my understanding of what reportable transactions are and listed transactions are, Mr. Chair.
Deborah, let me just ask this. So we do have statute that requires vendors of shelters to register in the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of any statutes that require them to register with the Department of Revenue, and I don't know where else they would register unless it is with a finance or some type of agency, but they are not required to register with the Department of Revenue.
So sellers of tax shelters are not required, so far as you know, to register anywhere?
Not with the Department of Revenue, and I'm not aware of them being required to register elsewhere.
Okay. And the shelters themselves, if we sell as you say, there are certain shelters that deal with nonprofit corporations and other kinds of transactions, do the shelters themselves require registration?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that they are not required to register with us. Now, they may be required to register as nonprofit organizations, obviously, with perhaps the Secretary of State Corporation Division. But as far as registering as a shelter with the Department of Revenue, there's no requirement I'm aware of, Mr. Chair.
I'm just taking this from my memory, and I'm looking at Representative Olson. My recollection is that there is a tax on illegal substances in some states, and the tax is 100% to be paid in kind. And that's how certain states confiscate illegal substances, is by taxing them in kind, and then you move from there. And that's why I ask about this: if these guys are required to register as vendors of tax shelters, then that may be another tool in the tool chest to get these folks corralled in at some particular point. I'm just looking for anything I can to try and help identify these. Now, my recollection is that years ago, the state of Oregon was so concerned about tax shelters that we set up a one-of-a-kind, unique in the United States, tax preparers program that was going to protect Oregon from all of these tax shelters. And then we get 10 years later information that Oregon is amongst the worst abusive states in the nation, on top 5 or 8 or 10, so far as abuses are concerned in that regard. So I'm concerned about what we've done, what message we've sent in that process, Deborah. So I would like to know where we stand with regard to this. And I've had the director tell me before that it's the best thing since sliced bread. But if we end up getting worse so far as our compliance is concerned, then maybe we're subscribing to the wrong kind of program. I did want to ask about, and I should have probably asked while Representative Kirsten was here, relative to corporations that are doing business in the state of Oregon sufficient that they can sell real estate. It's my understanding that in order to sell real estate in the state of Oregon, you've got to have some nexus in the state of Oregon. That is some registration. Do you know of any registration that's required?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of those requirements.
Okay. I thought that you had to have a registered agent in order to own real estate in the state of Oregon.
It's very possible, Mr. Chair. It's just outside my...
Well, I guess, again, that's a legal question. My concern is that if we say that immediately after they had no... This is with regard to the 4% withholding. If that corporation had no continuing business relationship in the state of Oregon, then at that point it's assumed that they would have dropped their business license in the state of Oregon. Other questions for Mr. Kennedy? Yes, Representative Boquist.
Deborah, can you talk briefly about the media campaign you're engaging?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boquist, what we anticipate is a fairly extensive media campaign. That's one thing we've learned in talking with other states that have run amnesty programs, is that it does need to have publicity. You need to let people know that it's going on, the time frames, who can apply for that. So we expect we would have probably some radio advertising, perhaps some short TV ads that we might be able to do through public interest spots, and newspaper, I don't know whether I said that already, contacting tax practitioners, certified public accountants, the licensed tax preparers through our listserv, and then also on our website, and other methods that we have to contact them and let them know what's going on, and then just a general public awareness, trying to make people aware of what's going on and their opportunity to come in and file under this.
We have a reality TV series. Five people with non-compliance in a room.
I had a question. Representative Volker has a follow-up. But the DOR is directed to run a general amnesty program between July 1st, 2006 through September 30, 2006. Is that prospective amnesty? Isn't that, how do we do a prospective amnesty program? Isn't that kind of like buying indulgences? How do you do a prospective amnesty program?
Mr. Chairman, the time period is correct. It would be July 1 through September 30th of 2006, and it's those taxpayers who have not filed returns with us that we don't know about would be able to come in during that time period and file their returns, pay their tax and interest, and no penalties would be charged.
So for 2005, we get off scot-free.
I believe it's for years prior to, tax years prior to January 1, 2005, Mr.
Okay.
Chair, if I recall.
Let's see. Representative Boquist, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. As a follow-up, and you may not know the answer, but you can come up later, because we've just broken down into two categories. Those people we don't know about, which we're trying to find, and those people we know about. And at a later point, I'm looking for a dollar figure of those we believe we know about, and a dollar figure for what the Revenue Department considers to be non-collectible. That's people we know that owe us taxes that we haven't been able to collect.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boquist, I don't have the figures.
No, I understand.
But if we know about them and we have assessed the tax. They're not eligible to participate in the amnesty. So we're collecting that money now, or trying to.
I fully understand that. Okay. I'm still looking for the number that is non-collectible or uncollectible or whatever the category is.
And they're not subject to the higher penalty that's provided for here either. Is that correct?
I would assume they're not. I'm just looking for that.
Representative Berger?
Deborah, there was discussion earlier on there's nothing in here that's going to tell us 2 years from now or 4 years from now how we did. Okay. What would that look like from your perspective if we put in here something that said do an amnesty program, but in some way measure its success? And how would we do that without cutting into its success in terms of its, you know, how much would that cost? I mean, I guess, do you have a vision for how that would work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, the bill does provide for an application process for people that want to participate in amnesty. So we will be able to track the people filing under this program and the dollars that are collected under the amnesty program.
Okay. So there is something. Okay. Because I, Mr. Chair, I would think that would be an important piece in this specific kind of
program. I feel a work group going on there for that.
Gee.
And he's looking at you, Madam Vice Chair.
Further questions, Representative Boulquist?
Just a follow-up, Mr. Chair. Deborah, any comment on, I believe we had several testimony in regards to page 2 of the law, and I'll read it out here. This, I think I used on the floor of the fishing expedition, wherever this, that has been specifically identified as a listed transaction by the Department of Revenue because the transaction has potential for tax avoidance. How do you interpret the department determining what has potential? It doesn't say it is taxable and has potential for tax avoidance.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boulquist, I believe the reason that that language is there is to allow the state to address state-specific issues that perhaps the federal government is not concerned about because they don't have a problem with those transactions. California has similar language, and they have identified two transactions that are listed transactions under state law that are not addressed by federal law, and those have to do with real estate investment trusts and I believe also regulated investment companies. So they have identified those as listed transactions for California's tax purposes. I'm assuming we would do similar things to say these are specific to the state, this is where there is a transaction that has a potential for tax abuse. It's not addressed by the federal government because they don't have those concerns.
Is it rational to assume, since the Revenue Department is very interested in identifying tax avoidance, that you already have in the department a fairly good idea of what these are or could define most of these?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boulquist, the two that I just spoke of are the ones that I know that we have identified as possibly needing to be addressed by rule. Those are the only two that I am personally aware of.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much, Deborah. Colleagues, we'll see this bill back again. In the meantime, we'll develop some kind of a work group around some of the issues that have been expressed and concern over the day, and we will get back to it. Please,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir. Representative.
May I ask staff, once we start talking about this 1031 exchange, I'm going to lay out a scenario here, and I would like staff to follow up on it and show me how we track this. I purchased a piece of property in Oregon for $100,000. I hold on to it for 5 years. I 1031 exchange it, and I go to Nevada and buy a piece of property for $200,000. I hold on that for 5 years, go to California, and purchase a piece of property for $400,000. When I sell that in California 5 years later, I may get $700,000, $600,000, whatever I get out of it. Now, according to the state of California...
You're an Oregonian this whole time?
Pardon?
You're an Oregonian this whole time?
Doesn't matter where I'm at.
Oh, okay.
Then, I sell that piece of property, but the state of California is looking at, I paid $400,000 for it, and I'm selling it for $600,000. When does the state of Oregon get paid for the $100,000?
Depends upon where you're living at the time the sale occurs. If you're living in Oregon at the time the sale occurs, you'll pay your tax not based upon the $100,000 or not based upon the $400,000 you bought it for, but you were doing 1031 exchanges. What are those? Those are tax deferments. Those are tax deferred exchanges. So your basis is exchanging each time. So consequently, your gain in California may well be a $750,000 sale with a $100,000 basis, a $650,000 gain in the state of California. You'll pay the California tax. If you're living in Oregon, then you'll take that as a credit on your Oregon return. So it depends. That's why I ask, where do you live when all of this is going on? If you want to move to Washington the day before the sale occurs,
then you can do it.
Then you can do it, but then you'll just pay California. The more likely bet is that you will swap this into California, or you'll swap from California into Washington and sell the Washington property.
$1 million homes.
That's true.
Yeah. We've been here.
He's living in Missouri.
We found a hole.
No, we found it a couple of days ago.
Okay. Colleagues, thank you for your patience today. We appreciate you being here. With that, we will close out for revenue today.
Paul?